if ever I feel like, you know, lost or what am I doing or why am I here, I am reminded that I was a kid who knew exactly what she wanted, and I owe it to her to push through all of it.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Tia Williams, author of the novel 7 Days in June. A former fashion editor and author of both YA and romance novels, Tia says she lived a very charmed life from the beginning of her career until she didn't.
It was extremely charmed. So much so that I was like, this is just how it goes. Like, I want to do this and then it happens. Then I want to do this and then it happens. And I was like, oh, I am ordained for success. But, you know, at some point you have to pay the bill. And I do want to say that I had everything that I had written in my college to-do list of what I was going to do as an adult by the time I was 35. And then by the time I was 38, I'd lost everything.
As a person who lives with chronic pain in the form of intractable migraines, Tia admits she leans into her ambition despite her invisible disability. Why she says it can be frightening to pursue freedom. Plus, the reason she believes Black writers should walk through all open doors, whether they're a trend or not. And how you fight for a happy ending. That and more is next when Black and Published continues.
My first question for you is, when did you know that you were a writer?
I've always known I was a writer. I was, ever since I could read, I was a writer. And I wrote my first book when I was 7. And it was in my mom's steno pad. It was called Peter and the Bunny. And I even wrote a about the author section on the back and put a picture of me at my kindergarten graduation.
You were very committed.
I was committed. I was focused. I was ambitious. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. Yeah, always.
And so you translated that into a life of magazine writing and book writing. So just give me the linear path because I see it's there.
Yeah. So I always had 2 obsessions, and it was fashion magazines and writing fiction. The same way I was like reading every book in front of me, I was also collecting fashion magazines from a really early age. All the Vogues, the Elles, Cosmo, Marie Claire, everything. And so I knew when I grew up that I wanted to be an editor at a fashion magazine. And I wanted to write fiction. So after I graduated from UVA in 1997, I moved to Brooklyn, as one does if you want to be a writer. And I started working as a beauty editor at Elle magazine.
First job?
Second job. I had one job for 3 months that was, I was working at Doubleday Books. I was working at a publisher as an editorial assistant. I knew that wasn't it. I needed to get to magazines, but there weren't any jobs open. And when I was at Doubleday, my boss was publishing a book by the editor-in-chief of a teen magazine. And through her, we heard about the L opening, and then I applied. So yeah, I worked at L, I worked at Glamour, Lucky, Essence, everywhere, Teen People. But when I was 24, like 3 years into my life in New York, I was like, okay, I need to write the books though. Like, when does that start? So I have the fashion stuff down, but like, when do I do the book stuff? And I would sit down to write books. I had all these like ideas, but nothing was really coming together. And I realized, oh, it's because I haven't like lived a life yet. I felt like I didn't have enough experience. But like by the time I was working at this magazine. It was really intense. My editor threw a bagel at my head. It was very Devil Wears Prada, that era. It was so hard. I was dating this very charismatic, like psychopath. Everything was going wrong. And so I put everything in storage, 24 years old. I quit my job and I moved to Seville, Spain to teach English and think for 6 months. While I was there, I sort of rewrote the story of my horrible romance, but like made it good. Like I rewrote it in my favor. Like I made him a great guy and I made our relationship work out and everything. And I sort of wrote it not realizing that it was the book that I've been wanting to write. It was more like therapy. But then when I got back to New York and started working again at, you know, at Condé Nast, and I read over and I was like, oh, this is the book. And so then I found an agent and sold it. And that was my first novel. It was published in 2004 called The Accidental Diva. And ever since then, I've been doing both. Well, up until 3 months ago, I quit my corporate job for the first time. So now, for the very first time, I am solely writing fiction.
Wow. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
I have lots of questions about Spain, because that was okay. Just like a, oh, I just went to Spain real quick. Yeah. But I don't know. I don't think I've ever met anyone who's like, okay, at 7, I knew I wanted to do this. I wanted to do this thing too. And then just did it with like, no, it seems very charmed, like no hiccups besides like, you know, the bagel and the trauma of magazines. How does it feel to have lived the life that you designed for yourself as a child?
Well, first I want to say it was extremely charmed. I can't, so much so that I was like, oh, things just work out for me. Like, this is just how it goes. Like, I want to do this and then it happens. Then I want to do this and then it happens. And I was like, oh, this is just the way, you know, I am ordained for success. Mm. But, you know, at some point you have to pay the bill. And I do want to say that I had everything that I had written in my college to-do list of what I was going to do as an adult by the time I was 35. And then by the time I was 38, I'd lost everything. So I'm the oldest of three girls. I'm very type A. I'm very orderly. I set goals and I do them. Like I feel very connected to who I was as a child. And if ever I feel like, you know, lost or what am I doing or why am I here? I am reminded that I was a kid who knew exactly what she wanted and I owe it to her to push through all of it. And yeah, I had a lot of early success. And then, you know, around 2012, 2013, I'm in my mid-30s. I'm now divorced. I have to sell the apartment that my first novel bought in, you know, a fancy Brooklyn neighborhood. I'm now a single mom. I get laid off from my magazine job because I don't know anything about digital and that's where the world is going. It's no longer about print. So I'm out of work. I'm a single mom. I have to move to a kind of a sketchy part of town. And I had to completely start over and reinvent myself because I felt like my luck had run out. It had. And one of the reasons it was so devastating and dark to me that those couple of years where I was trying to get back on my feet, it was because I was like, no, I win. Like I'm supposed to get everything. I do, you know, and it's like you write it down and you do it and you get it. Like, what else is there? That's just how life works. And that isn't how life works. And, you know, so I wasn't prepared for things going wrong. So you learn a lot about yourself when things do.
Is that when you began working on The Perfect Find? And
that was The Perfect Find. Yeah. Because that was, you know, Jenna's story was my story.
So let's talk about publishing. Because you mentioned when you finished Accidental Diva in Spain and came back and you got an agent right away and, you know, published your first book and then you did the second one in the midst of crisis. But you also talked about how publishing changed in the magazine industry as well. So what has your publishing journey in both places been like as the industry has changed and Amazon changed everything and digital has come in and all these different forms of dissemination for work?
Yeah, well, it was I actually wrote three books before The Perfect Find, but the other two were YA. So totally different world, totally different time. No social media, not even Facebook, like nothing. With the two YA books, MySpace was the thing. Whatever years they were, it was MySpace. Like that was the only thing. But it was harder to sell a book because you only had a couple ways to sell a book. And if you were a Black author, you know, traditionally published, like they weren't putting money, marketing dollars behind your book Like you, people were going to go in the bookstore and never find it. They did find it. It would be like on a black shelf, you know, in the back somewhere. You didn't get the same distribution, of course. And it's honestly, it's still like that. It's getting better, you know, but back then it was totally bleak. There were like two black book editors, and self-publishing wasn't real. I mean, you could do that, but like there was no infrastructure yet. Like self-publishing really flourished once there was social media, and blogging helped usher all of that in too. Before blogs and, you know, live journal and things like that, it was, you had a couple ways to get your words out. It was publishing a book, writing for newspapers, writing for magazines, and that is it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so after that, when sort of the digital world opened up and you were, you know, able to find your voice and find an audience in different ways, that really changed the nature of book publishing too. But yeah, you know, and now like in a post Me Too, you know, post BLM era where companies and brands and industries are now being held accountable for having like, you know, some sort of semblance of diversity, you know, publishing is much more open to Black and Brown and LGBTQ plus voices, different gender expressions, like different, you know, in the romance genre, you know, differently abled bodies, differently shaped bodies, like all of that. It does just, you start to worry if it's a trend, you know, but any door that's open, we need to walk through it. So things have definitely changed quite a bit.
Okay. I want to ask about something that you said about your Black authors are on the shelf, on a Black shelf in the back, and no one finds it. And I've heard this discussion lots of times, like, you know, ban the Black book section or whatever. Mm-hmm. However, as a reader, when I was a kid, I loved to go into the bookstore and go right to the Black book section because I knew where my people were.
Right.
I knew where the stuff that I wanted, where it was. And so I guess I want to have a deeper conversation about that, because if there's only that one, is it because there's only that one section that then all the Black authors have to fight for space on the, in that one case on those like six shelves?
There are a couple problems, and I do totally understand what you're saying. It's the same thing as like, you know, knowing that you can go straight to Essence and they'll have, you know, stuff for you. Like, you know where to go, you know. However, if there's one shelf, you have 30 genres all next to each, you know, it's like you can have a cookbook next to a science fiction book. There is no world in which, you know, Harry Potter would be next to 50 Shades of Grey, would be next to Gone Girl. It just doesn't make any sense. It's haphazard. It's like, let's put all the Black stuff together and they'll figure it out. We should be given the same dignity as any, that's what it is. It's just like, you know, I'm not even in my genre. Like my genre is my ethnicity, and you would never see a section called the white section. The whole bookstore is the white section. It's the same reason why Black History Month is so annoying. It's like we get 1 month, the shortest month, and Black history is your history. It's everybody's history. Like, so it feels ghettoized. If you're on one shelf, there's limited space, and now you're competing against each other. And then it makes it much easier for publishers to say, oh, but we already have our Black romance. Oh, no, we already have a Black Western. So we don't need another one, because where would we even put it? Where would we market it? It just keeps us small. It keeps us ghettoized. That's the only word I can think of. And that's how it feels. And it has real world, like, financial implications.
How so?
Well, just like I was saying, like, in, you know, if there's only limited space in the bookstores for Black authors, publishers then are able to say, well, we can only publish a couple of Black authors because where else would they go? So there's that. There's also, if you know that you're just putting them on this, in this one section or on this one shelf, there's no need to put any marketing money behind it because it's never going to be in the front anyway. It's never going to be in the window. It's never going to have a display. So it just, it puts the bar extremely low on what a Black author can do. when they're just pushed to the side in that way and they don't get, you know, the attention or the money or the budget that another author might get.
How has it changed over your years of being in the industry?
It's changed quite a bit, thank God. I mean, you can walk into any bookstore and see how it's changed. And then it hasn't, because you can also see, you know, book talk tables, and it's, you know, the books that are popular on TikTok right now. And I know of Black books that are very popular on TikTok, on book talk, and they're never on the displays. There are certain authors that get more push behind them as opposed to what a similar like comp title would get. But they're Black, but they're an Indigenous voice. So like last year, I went to Boston because my daughter is obsessed with witches. And so we went to Boston, we went to Salem in October, and we had like this whole like witch journey. And I went to this independent bookstore. I walk in and this woman says to me, "Oh, are you looking for Black Lives Matter?" And that's how she said it. And I was like, looking for, like, just based on grammar, like, I don't understand your question. Am I looking for Black Lives Matter? Like, I don't know. She's like, "Oh yeah, Black Lives Matter. It's right over there." So they had like a section called Black Lives Matter. And I was like, that's not a book genre. Like, first of all, that's like a call to action. It's a movement. It's a hashtag.
It's a foundation. It's an organization. It's a lot of things, but it's not a genre.
But it's not a book genre. Like, to be like, "Are you looking for Black Lives Matter?" is just really weird. And then also, like, we're still doing that? Like, and like I was saying earlier, in the Black Lives Matter section, it was, you know, every genre ever just thrown together. And it hurts my feelings. It makes me feel sad. It's like these authors worked so hard and all they are is Black in this store. Big old store full of like white authors are able to have, you know, to write a fantasy about a unicorn and a, you know, fairy falling in love. They are able to write a ponderous 1,000 page story about two teens who met on a lazy summer day, like, you know, on a beach in New England with like no real plot. Like, they're able to do so many different things. But if we do it, it has to be, first of all, spectacular. And even in its, you know, spectacularness, it's relegated to a Black Lives Matter display. It's weird.
Is that why when you got ready for 7 days in June, you threw every plot you could ever imagine at it? Because we had the witches, we had the werewolves, and then there was the whole backstory. There was the teenage love. There was the adult love. Like all the things that Black people are, Black writers are said to shy away from or expected not to tackle, you put in 7 days in June with some pop culture flair as well.
Yeah.
Is that why were doing that?
I was just fed up. Like, The Perfect Fine had been such a disaster. I was rejected by every traditional publisher in the industry, The Perfect Fine. And I published it with a very, very indie label that was so indie that it was almost like doing it myself. And I was so frustrated by the feedback because ever we don't like this. It was always, "This was so much fun, but where was the Black oppression?" Or, "This was so much fun," or like, you know, "But you just, can we talk a little bit more about how it must have been so hard and traumatic for Jenna to be a fashion editor, like in this super white industry, and she's Black?" And I'm like, that was not the story at all. You know, some editors were even like, "Can we change the industry? Because we can't even see Black people in the fashion industry. That's just weird." And I'm like, you're actually looking at, you know, someone who does this for a living, but it didn't matter. I was just frustrated by it. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to write like a genreless book about whatever comes to my head with like 15 different plot lines and time jumps and time skips and 1,000, you know, secondary characters and a kid. And like, I was like, whatever, I'm just gonna, whatever I want to do, I want to do. And I dare anyone to say, this is too much for a Black book. And honestly, I think because of timing, because, I mean, you know, post-Trump, everyone was sort of shell-shocked and realizing that, oh, we need to listen to what Black people have to say, I guess, that the industry was more open to it. Yeah, I think timing had more to do with it than anything, because if this had been 2014, I don't think anyone would have bought it.
Wow. That's really honest. So let's get to this book, 7 Days in June, with Eva Mercy and Shane, and then I can ask you all my questions from the book.
Okay.
Black and Published family, it's time for the reading. 7 Days in June by Tia Williams chronicles the love story of Eva Mercy and Shane Hall. Written on dual timelines, the two meet in high school, and after a week of sex, drugs, and lust, a near tragedy tears them apart. When they meet again as adults at the height of the literary world, they're forced to face what happened in their past and decide whether it's worth forging a future. Here's Tia.
Okay, I'll read the prologue. In the year of our Lord, 2019, 32-year-old Eva Mercy nearly choked to death on a piece of gum. She had been attempting to masturbate when the gum lodged in her throat, cutting off her air supply. As she slowly blacked out, she kept imagining her daughter, Audrey, finding her flailing about in Christmas jammies while clutching a tube of strawberry lube and a dildo called the quarterback, which vibrated at a much higher frequency than advertised, gum choking frequency. The obituary headline would be Death by Dildo. Hell of a legacy to leave her orphaned 12-year-old. Eva didn't die, though. She eventually coughed up the gum. Shaken, she buried the quarterback in a drawer full of hip-hop concert tees, slipped on her ancient cameo ring, and padded down the hall to wake up Audrey for her BFF's Hamptons birthday party. She had no time to dwell on her brush with mortality. While she'd admit to being a damn good mom and a capable novelist, Eva's true talent was her ability to push weird shit aside and get on with life. This time, she did it a little too well and missed the obvious. When Eva Mercy was little, her mom had told her that Creole women see signs. This was back when Eva's only understanding of Creole was that it was vaguely connected to Louisiana and Black people with French last names. It wasn't until junior high that she realized her mom was, what's a fair word, eccentric. And she curated these signs to justify her whims. The point is, Eva was wired to believe that the universe sent her messages. It occurred to her to expect a life-altering drama after Trident Gate. After all, she'd had a near-death experience before. And that time, like this one, she woke up to her world forever changed.
So you talked a little bit before when we were talking about publishing that because the industry has changed so much and it seems more accepting of differences and disabilities and LGBTQIA plus voices and things like that. And Eva Mercy has an invisible disability that you discuss throughout the novel. Why was it important for you to center someone like that in the story?
Because I am someone like that. I've had chronic migraines since I was 9 years old. I was diagnosed with intractable migraines, which means incurable, and no one knows why. And it's been a very, you know, it's a struggle. And anyone with chronic pain, whether it's, you know, fibromyalgia or lupus or, you know that it sort of colors every facet of your life. Especially because more or less these are invisible disabilities. I mean, they are invisible disabilities. You're not in a wheelchair. You're not limping. You're not bleeding. You're not, you know, you whatever quote unquote normal is, that's what you look like. So you find yourself masking and pretending all of the time because no one would believe that you're as sick as you are and struggling the way you are. And also everyone gets a headache sometimes, like, you know, when you're hungover, or maybe you just haven't had your coffee yet or whatever. And when you tell people you have a migraine, they're thinking of that. They're like, you know, the amount of times people offer me like aspirin or Advil or, you know, and it's like, no, actually a migraine. I mean, my bad day is the ER and hospitalization for a week with IVs in my arm. And it's pain you can't run from, pain you can't fix with a pill or anything. And it affects your work life. It affects your love life. It affects your friendships. You're never reliable. You know, I can say yes to things, but it's a no the day of, because now I can't. It affects how you parent. You know, when I started writing 7 days in June, it was, you know, some years, some seasons, some months, some days are worse than others. And that was a bad year. And I was basically, after I got home from work, I was raising my daughter from the couch. Like, I'd order dinner from the couch, never make it, like, cannot. We'd do her homework while I'm on the couch. I would detangle her hair on the couch. Like, I would read her a bedtime story on the couch, like everything. And I was like, this is not life. And so I wanted to create a character that I could sort of live vicariously through, who had the same problems and found love and found a way to live and got all of the good things despite having this disability. So that's what I did. Yeah.
How were you even able to write under such intense pressure in your own head from the migraines?
Yeah, I never know how to answer that question because I've always had migraines and I've always, I don't know what it's like to do regular things without having to fight through pain to do them. I'm a very highly functioning person. And I think that it's because I've always had this thing to fight against. And like, anyone with chronic pain will tell you, if you stop, if you get off the treadmill, you'll never get back on because you feel like shit. And I always felt like, okay, if I don't push through and I don't, you know, nail the SATs, if I don't kill it in college, if I don't go get this, like, pursue this insane career that keeps me on my toes, if I don't do these things, I'm just going to waste away in my bedroom. I always felt like I only had two options. I have to go hard to outrun this thing. Because if I sit in it, I'm just going to stay there.
Did you know that even from when you were like a teenager, young adult? Because like you talking about, you know, got the job at Doubleday, then I got the job at Elle, then I got the first book deal. Like it is very much, it's high functioning, but it's high functioning ambitious. But is it because you know that if you don't do those things, you won't do anything?
Yeah. I have like a real like depressed stoner loser thing, like right behind me, like wanting to just, you know, take over. It's right there, like right behind my chair. And it has always been right there. Like, I remember seeing the kids at school that just like leaned into that whole thing, like, fuck everything. Like, and I remember looking at them and just being jealous, like, oh my God, they just feel like they can, that must be such freedom just to be like, fuck it. I just don't care. But I felt the pull of that so strongly that my life would be over. Like if I did that, my life would be over. I would never come out of that. And so I just ran another direction always.
But even in you running and you saying it being right there, it's right there for Eva.
She was exactly.
Known, or when she was known as Genevieve, which yes. You know, I love as her first name, as her real first name.
Because Genevieve.
Yes. My favorite author was Eric Jerome Dickey. And that book
kind
of just set my world on fire. But yeah, she has that darkness in her. And then the man she loves also has that darkness and like enables it. So in talking about when you say, you know, you're going to throw all the plots at it and just let it be what it is. Was that important to let that side of you live at least fictionally?
Yeah. Yeah. And also I have never seen like, you know, when I was a teenager, I was really into like Prozac Nation and, you know, I would read Sylvia Plath, like all these depressed white women, you know, I couldn't find like, you know, depression books from Black women about like Black suburban teenage depression and hopelessness. Like, you know, there was The Coldest Winter Ever. I could relate more to Girl Interrupted than her, just because where I was from. And I was like, where's that story? You know, like it always seems like some white shit when Black girls cut themselves or have eating disorders. And it's why we hide them so much, because it doesn't seem like culturally that's something that we're supposed to be doing. Mm. And maybe our grandmothers will be like, you just need to pray on that because I don't even know what that is.
Like, I'm going to need you to work that out because we've got racism to fight.
Yeah, like this is such a sidebar. As I was writing 7 Days of June, I talked to so many Black social workers. And the stories they told me just about the things that Black kids go through and never tell a soul, you know, and they just sit with us and sit with us and they fester. And so I wanted to touch on generational trauma, too, like the stuff we just kind of inherit. And then, you know, like Eva just woke up and was like, I'm breaking this now. Like it stops here.
Why was it important for you to show that kind of healing, even in the midst of so much pain?
Because it'll just keep going on. And you see this so much, like, you know, Black parents punishing Black kids because they see a freedom before them that they weren't afforded. Mm. And it just doesn't seem fair or realistic for their kids to feel it or pursue it. And it comes from a place of fear. Like, you know, we want to protect our kids from all the darkness in the world. But in doing that, sometimes you're also handicapping them and filling up their cup with all your shit and your grandparents' shit. And, you know, we've got to allow them to go have a different kind of life. And having issues that are smaller than yours is a gift. You know, that's the gift that you're providing the next generation, that they don't have to worry about what you worried about, or they don't have to keep quiet what you had to keep quiet forever. And they get to honor themselves in ways that we weren't allowed. I think that's really important. And also I wanted to show that Eva, in trying so hard to break her generational curses, had a lot of blind spots. I mean, and the biggest one was that she was basically lying to her child about where she came from and who she even really was. And that's a big problem too.
What do you want younger Black readers to get from this book whenever they get to it?
I want them to feel a sense of freedom. Because look at these characters. Like, Eva is writing vampire erotica. She found a way to excel in, you know what I mean? In an extremely white industry, writing this like random super niche, you know, these genre books. You know, we have Audrey, who has not a care in the world. That feels like freedom, to have this Black kid wandering, you know, unpressed through life. She's 12. It won't last long. Like, she will have, you know, a moment of reckoning. But like, for the moment, it feels like freedom. What Shane has, the life that Shane has carved out for himself, he should be dead. And I think that Eva and Shane are both fighting for a happy ending. And you also know that their road together is not going to be easy either, because, you know, they have to be triggers for each other. Like, after the end, like, you know, they both have to go to therapy, like extensive, you know, so it's not going to be easy for them, but you know, they want it. They want to fight for it. That's important.
All right. So I have a little game for you, speed round in the game, and then I'll let you go for the morning, almost afternoon. So what is your favorite book?
Probably Their Eyes Were Watching God, by Zora Neale Hurston.
Who is your favorite author?
Stephen King, without a doubt. I love horror, and he's the master. And like, when people are like, what's your favorite beach read? I'm like, it. Scary, like Christine, like that. That's my like easy reading. Yeah.
As long as you're on a beach and you're reading, it's a beach read. It doesn't matter.
It's a beach read.
It's a beach read. What is your favorite TV show?
P-Valley.
Yes! Yes! Oh,
it's so good.
Uncle Clifford and Lil Murder. Oh my gosh.
I mean, a love story for the ages.
They gotta make it.
Yeah.
What do you think is the best book to movie adaptation since you will have a couple coming out?
I really loved Waiting to Exhale. I thought that was very, the Terry McMillan ones were really good. Stella was fabulous.
Disappearing Acts.
Yeah. It just, not good ones are the ones like where you've read the book, you love the book, and you watch the movie or the TV show and you're taken out of it. Like something takes you out of it. And you're like, no, that character would never say that. Or no, that would never have happened. And in the Terry McMillan adaptations, it felt really faithful to the books and even provided a little bit more, you know, like it took it a little bit further. So yeah, I thought those were good.
If money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
I would be doing the same thing. I would be writing, absolutely. But I would be writing from Turks and Caicos or Paris, one or the other.
And then, is there something that you want to do that you have not done yet or don't think that you can?
I've never been anywhere in Africa. And I know that I can, but I have not. I am dying to make the Ghana trip. I have to make the Ghana trip. Everyone I know has made it. It is time. When you're writing, like it's like I'm always chained to the desk and there's always another deadline. And I feel like I can't get up and go anywhere because going in is a distraction. Even going to the grocery store is a distraction. So I can't go to Ghana, but I'm dying to go.
I was talking to my mom and I was like, we're going to Ghana in 2 years. That's when my nephew will graduate from high school and my daughter should be potty trained by then. So I'm like, I'm going to get them passports. I'm going to just save up some money. And in 2 years, we're just going to go. And she was like, okay.
Smart.
And then what brings you joy?
Trader Joe's limited edition banana pudding ice cream. It has Nilla wafers in it. It's good.
That's highly specific. I love it. And what brings you peace?
Beach. I have to go back to, whenever, and it can be any beach. It can be the Rockaways. It can be, actually, I won't even say the beach, a body of water, like just watching the sea. Ocean air or the sea air, the lake air, whatever it is, the river. And my head always feels better by water. So that's my peaceful place.
All right. So our game is called Rewriting the Classics. We'll see how far we get. Name one book you wish you would have written.
Oof, Beloved.
Everybody says that.
Does everyone say that?
I've had a lot of people say Beloved. Some say it just because of the Nobel. Some say it because it's Beloved. It really doesn't need a reason. It's Beloved. But a lot of people say Beloved.
That's so funny. I picked that because for me, that is the best horror novel ever written. To me, that's horror. And people, I got into a whole thing with someone about this because like, depending on who you are, where you are in your life, whether or not you're a parent, Beloved takes on different colors, different flavors. And, you know, it could be so many different genres. Mm-hmm. To me, it is just a nightmare. It's a nightmare ghost story. And I just think it's so rich and it's probably the best book ever written, right?
Yeah. I mean,
it's Beloved.
It's Beloved. I don't argue against that.
Yeah.
I do see how it is definitely a horror novel because it is horrifying. Yeah. Name one book where you want to change the ending and how would you do it?
Change the ending. That's really, really hard. But 7 Days in June, I started thinking about it when I was thinking about Romeo and Juliet and what if they hadn't died at the end, you know, what if the, you know, teenage Romeo and Juliet had this like wild, you know, love affair and then went their separate ways and then met again as like 35-year-olds, what would happen? And that was where 7 Days in June came from. So Romeo and Juliet would be my answer, even though it's a play, it's not a book.
Same difference. And then name a book that you think is overrated or overtaught and why.
Anything by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Great Gatsby, maybe. And I think it's the reason I think it's annoying, his books, are because it's the classic, like, patriarchal backstory is that he was stealing all of his material from his wife, Zelda, who was a brilliant, brilliant writer. But because she was a woman and it was the 20s, like, she didn't have any outlet. And she would write these beautiful diary entries, and he would take entire passages from her, not even tell her, and then write these books based on her ideas and her words, and they would become American classics. And he's lauded as, like, a hero. And she died in a fire at a mental institution where he had her committed.
That took a turn.
Yeah.
All right. So my final question for you today is, when you are dead and gone and no longer here, what is something that you would like someone to write about the legacy of words and work that you left behind?
I would like for people to say that she gifted us with her stories, because that's how I think of them. Like, I write them as to Black women, Black women specifically. Anyone outside of Black women who likes them and loves them and relates to them, fabulous. But they're for us, because we need escapism. We need fantastic, delicious love stories that we can get lost in. We need these gifts. And that's how I think of them. And I hope that's how they're received.
Thank you, Tia.
Thank you.
Big thank you to Tia Williams for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Tia's latest novel, 7 Days in June. And if you're not following Tia, check her out on the socials. She's at Tia Williams Writes on Instagram and Tia_W_Writes on Twitter. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Tia about how her mom inspired her to want to write Black love stories. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holla at y'all next week when our guests will be Danielle Smith, author of Shine Bright, a very personal history of Black women in pop.
When you're just going through a list of famous, gifted, talented Black women singer, songwriters, executives, producers, and if they are dealing with straight men, it's just so often things go so terribly. To just have it confirmed for me, what I know from personal experience about a good amount of men being uncomfortable with the success, confidence, and high levels of creativity that I try to bring to any situation, that is common. It's common at 20 grand a year. It's common at 20 million.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.